Ultra, the beloved and hated music festival, may have lost its home in Miami. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Ultra Music Festival has taken place in Miami since 1999, but this upcoming March, it's not going to happen at its normal location. The city of Miami won't renew the contract for Bayfront Park. Where will it go now? Can a deal be salvaged? Also, the risks of head trauma have been at the forefront these past few years when we talk about football. But much of the conversation has been about pro players. What about the risk to high school athletes? One ethicist believes schools should dump the sport to protect the students. Finally, Lemon City Trio is a psychedelic funk band with roots deep in Miami. Today, we return to Live from the 305. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Starting things off a bit festive, but you're listening to the sounds from last year's Ultra Music Festival. The massive international electronic music three-day event has brought thousands of fans of dance music to Bayfront Park over the last 18 years. But the bumping bass lines, major traffic congestion, and takeover of the park could be to the festival's demise. Last week, the Miami City Commission unanimously voted not to renew the festival's contract for Bayfront Park. The Miami Herald's Joey Fletches was at the City Commission meeting, and he has details on maybe the future of the event. We'll also get an update on a public health investigation underway right now in Overtown. Joey, great to have you back.
Good to be back.
All right. Come on. You ever been to Ultra? You said for work.
I have been to Ultra for work a couple of years ago, for 2 years in a row. I was sent to cover the festival from a human interest angle. Spent 3 days there each time. Talking to people who were enjoying the festivities, and it was interesting.
Nobody wants to see this old man even try. You know what? Take us to that city commission meeting. The vote was last Thursday. What kind of conversations were they having, before they made their vote? What was going on?
Well, they were talking about a problem that really is not a new one. And for some people, it's more of a problem than for others, right? Ultra has had a home on Miami's waterfront for 18 years, mostly Bayfront Park for a little while and Bicentennial Park, now Museum Park. And the complaint has always been as residences rose up, condo towers were built, people moved in, the complaints were increasingly loud music, traffic in my neighborhood, my windows are rattling, my dishes are rattling, I have to leave for the weekend, and also I don't have access to my park. You know, the idea being that Ultra takes, weeks to set up and weeks to tear down. So it's not just an inconvenience for that three-day festival. Yeah. Yeah, it's the run-up and, the aftermath. And so that is the conversation that has been really in motion for several years now, but he really heated up this year.
And it was Commissioner Joe Carollo. He negotiated the contract with the festival, but then he jumped over to the opposition. I mean, how did his position on the deal change over time? I mean, what happened?
That's an interesting question because he definitely, so Miami has an interesting setup where Carollo is the chairman of the Bayfront Park Management Trust. It's this governmental agency that manages Bayfront Park and technically is the city entity that negotiates the contract with Ultra or any entity that has a festival or event there. But he's also commissioner, and it's not his district. It's Commissioner Ken Russell's district. So there's some political things going on there. And those two guys, they haven't been getting along lately. And they've feuded and clashed on a couple different things. And the residents go to one or go to the other. And because they've been so fired up about Ultra this year, because their five-year contract expired. And so that's why we're talking about a new one, possibly, although maybe after last week, possibly not. Carollo was in position to negotiate this deal. He took it to the commission, but then he said, I'm just trying to negotiate a good deal so that my colleagues could consider it, but I don't actually support this. And that took Ken Russell by surprise.
So does it seem like, I guess, the residents really have more sway than the fans? Because it does bring a lot of fans, but maybe a lot of them aren't from here anyway. So the chorus on one side is just going to be louder than the other.
Could be. I think that the residents definitely feel that they have finally mustered more political clout than, you know, what they would characterize as the business interest of Ultra. But it's, you're right. I mean, there are lots of people who act, that aren't in it just to make a ton of money. In fact, Ultra costs a lot of money, and a lot of people spend that money to go from all over the world. Yeah. So it's, you, not just, you know.
As you said, it was interesting that, I mean, 18 years, and so Miami's changed a lot. So a lot of buildings have popped up, and so you have more people.
Right.
But take us back and explain how the festival got started here.
It was much smaller. It started in Miami Beach. So we've had Winter Music Conference since the 80s, and that was the sort of preeminent electronic music gathering in Miami-Dade County, in the country. And that spun off Ultra when a couple of local folks, these guys, got together and said, we're going to do a rave, an 11-hour rave down in South Beach in Collins Park. Happened in 1998, 1999, and then they outgrew the space. And that's how Ultra was born. It went across the bay. And it remained on the waterfront ever since. And so it's really become a and now just this year, Ultra actually bought Winter Music Conference. So, you know, so the child sort of swallowed the parent there over the past few decades.
Besides noise, I mean, it's had its issues on and off with the issue of drugs. Mm-hmm. And there was I believe, an incident at one point not too long ago where, I mean, people have always been trying to break in. But there were issues with that, too. So there were, police have always had a challenge with this.
Yeah, it definitely, over the years that Ultra has grown and grown, it developed a reputation for being a place where kids would go and get messed up on drugs. And that can be exaggerated, overstated. However, there have been some kind of high-profile moments, like online. I mean, a couple of years ago, there was a video that circulated of a young woman who was... looked like she was making out with a tree. And then what you're referencing is actually what happened about 3 years ago, where a group of people who wanted to get into the concert didn't have tickets. They crashed a fence, toppled it, and in the process, they trampled a security guard who suffered serious injuries. And that was a very, very big moment, because after that, Ultra became 18 and up. For years, it was all ages, which you might think, well, how could that have been, right? But it was, and now it's 18 and up. And since then, things have very much calmed down. I covered the first year after that age change, and they also put up reinforced fencing, so it's like impossible to break in now, and up security. And those have made a huge difference.
So what is Ultra now telling folks, I mean, for anybody who's bought tickets ahead of time?
They've sent out a message that is rather optimistic, and they believe... and they've told me the same, that they can still salvage a deal here. They can remain in Miami on the waterfront. As I was just checking before this program, and as far as the administration in the city of Miami, they haven't heard on new contract terms. But they made it sound, the Ultra folks made it sound last week, like they're still going to try to make this happen somehow. And so, you know, I'm curious to see what, if they come back with some new concessions, perhaps.
They're confident that it'll be at Bayfront. Well, not just in Miami, but at Bayfront and the water?
Their first choice is Bayfront. They've always maintained that, and they say that because they recognize and value the image and the brand that they've built. You know, it's streamed all over the world, and millions of people watch it, and they see, you know, people partying and the skyline behind them. And that's really what they're going for. But that doesn't mean that if things just didn't work out, that they wouldn't try to look somewhere else. But they don't want to talk about that. I've asked about what is plan B. They say, well, you know, a good business person has a plan B, but that doesn't mean we need to talk about it right now.
Have you heard, I wonder if online, you know, what's being said on Twitter or anything, like, you know, what fans are saying about the possibility that it won't happen? Because it's in March. It's supposed to happen in March.
I mean, when we were writing about this vote last week, there were a lot of people who came out and said, oh my gosh, like, I was really looking forward to going. Now I guess I can't go. And, you know, it's tough because, you know, you have to kind of respond and explain, like, well, no one has said Ultra is canceled. And in fact, tickets have been on sale and continue to be. Does this mean things could change? Yes, but how? We just don't know right now. So, you know, some people were more... upset about it. Some people were actually in disbelief, and they sort of said, uh-uh, no way. Like, Ultra released a statement and said, look, they're going to make it happen no matter what. I'm like, okay, well, you know, let's see if the contract comes back. You know, I'll let you know as soon as I know, right?
A lot of residents in the area probably will dispute that. I'm talking with Miami Herald's Joey Fletcher. Again, Miami City Commission voted last week to not renew the music festival Ultra's contract at Bayfront Park. Ultra's been hosted at Bayfront in downtown Miami now for years. Again, this is celebrating almost 18 years now. Well, I mean, as we heard, they're confident it's going to happen, but we'll see if there's a contract. I'm going to switch things up here real quickly. There's a story you wrote, published today in the Miami Herald, about a public health investigation right now in Overtown. Police have shut down four streets underneath the 836 freeway. They're looking into an HIV and hepatitis C outbreak. What's going on in the investigation right now?
So the health department, which is the local health department, is an arm of the state health department. They have been out and they've been drawing blood. They've been interviewing people in this homeless community that has gathered on sidewalks underneath these roads in Overtown. And they are trying to figure out if there is what diseases are being transmitted and if there's a higher incidence of transmission. There's an indication. The health department doesn't want to really comment publicly about the status of the investigation or the severity of the situation that they've already identified. But it's starting to come out in public forums, like the city commission meeting last week, the school board meeting last night, where homeless advocates and some other officials are saying, oh, we're aware of this problem that has become a serious problem, HIV, hepatitis C, but what I don't have right now is our numbers.
And, which means they're not talking about even the severity of it.
Correct. It would seem as though that this has risen to a level of serious concern, but as far as the number of people who are infected and if this is more than usual, we're not getting that information right now.
What needle exchange programs are currently in place in the city to try to prevent this?
The IDEA Exchange, which is run from the University of Miami, has been working in this area for 2 years now because there hasn't actually been a needle exchange program in the state of Florida longer than 2 years. And 16 is when it was approved. And it was actually approved without any public funding. So this program really sustains itself through donations, through private fundraising. And it's run by doctors who go out and actually interact with these people day to day. They accept dirty needles and provide clean ones. And by and large, in other parts of this country, that concept has been proven in the sense that it does lower the infection rate. So it'll be interesting to see, I suppose, you know, what is the root cause? What's happening that's different now that's causing this health issue?
And so I should back up then. If we really aren't getting an idea of numbers or, you know, the severity of it, then really, I mean, is anybody calling it an outbreak? It's not an outbreak, right?
I didn't use that word, and I hesitate to do that.
Yeah,
because
I think I didn't. I want to back up. I want to make sure that if we don't know, I don't want to throw that out there.
No, sure. Yeah, I think that's maybe a strong word at this point, simply because we're not aware. I mean, I'll say this. There is a circuit court judge who called this meeting with multiple state agencies and told me in my interview with him that they are corralling resources, money from across different agencies to address this as fast as they can and to get everyone out there who's infected into a drug treatment program. But everyone out there, I don't know how many that is. Now, I was out there myself, and there are several dozen people who are living on those sidewalks, but I don't know. I mean, that's where the health department comes in, and they're the ones, they're the professionals. I don't know who's infected, who's not.
Have we heard anything from Miami-Dade Public School Superintendent Alberto Carvalho?
So yesterday, the chairman of the Homeless Trust, Ron Book, actually spoke to the school board, and the superintendent commented on what he was sharing, which was this, that there's this problem, and that's only right down the street, right? So the superintendent actually messaged parents last night of nearby schools saying, be on the lookout if you see needles that have been disposed or refuse or people sleeping outside of schools to notify the school administration. There's a concern that, you know, there is a health hazard here, that needles are actually ending up near schools that where kids could step on them or grab them. And, you know, that's so it's starting to really we're in a situation where this is starting to really swell up and it's getting attention.
Yeah.
But what we don't know and also don't want to be alarmist about, to be honest here, is just how bad this is, how widespread, you know, what concentrations there are of each disease. And what happens next? You know, it's interesting. And spending time out there with these people, some of whom have been living there for multiple years, some of whom have been down on their luck more recently. You know, there's a lot of folks who want to get help. They want to find a way to dislodge themselves from a cycle of addiction. They feel like, you know, if there was a program that fit them well, they would take advantage of it. So it's a complex problem. It's a complex problem.
And this, again, a story Jory Fletcher has got in the Miami Herald today. Again, a public health investigation right now in Overtown. Police have shut down four streets underneath the 836 freeway as they look into this HIV and hepatitis C situation. And again, not to call it an outbreak, but they're looking at the situation. Not a lot of information out there yet on numbers or anything like that, but something to keep an eye on. And also, as he mentioned, still following up on this story, as to what the city of Miami is going to do with the contract they have with Ultra, if there's going to be an Ultra Music Festival this upcoming year or not, which is in March, it was when it was planned. We'll wait and see. Fans might be disappointed, maybe not, but we'll find out. We'll hear more about it. Joey will keep us informed. Thank you so much, as always, man. I appreciate it.
Always good to be here.
Again, the Miami Herald's Joey Fletcher joining us. Well, still to come, so many of us love high school football. It's a tradition in a lot of communities. But what if that game was doing severe damage to our kids? Should we ban it? We'll have more on that coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. High school football is a huge part of life for many communities in South Florida, throughout the country. But that could change in the coming years because of a declining participation and also health concerns. Oxbridge Academy in West Palm Beach recently shut down its program after going to the state final the year before. Now, the coach says they couldn't get enough players to field a team and be competitive. And, of course, fears of brain trauma and CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, have stoked greater fears in parents. It's not just that football pro players are struggling with this. Recently, the Journal of American Medical Association reported that they found CTE in 110 of 111 former NFL players. But the statistic that doesn't get a lot of attention, they found CTE in 3 of every 14 high school players. We asked you to text in this week about whether you would let your children play football. We got some interesting responses. Luis Matut from Dania Beach texted in. He said, I'm a parent of a 3-year-old, and I would not let my son play football. It's an exclusive game set up to allow kids and young men to sacrifice their bodies, minds, and health for entertainment. It's particularly exploitative of minorities, and I liken it to gladiator games. The saying goes, it's not if they will get injured, it's when. This is a brutal game that punishes the body tremendously. Moises Igosi from Weston, Florida, has 3 boys, ages 12, 18, and 21. He said this, short and long-term effects are ridiculous. They all wanted to play. It was a major point of contention. One of my boys was being recruited by universities and had only played 2 preseason games. Awful. And it's about money, not the kids' health and development. Well, a recent paper was published in a Harvard Educational Review challenging school districts by stating it's ethically wrong to have sports like football when it's the job of schools to protect students. Professor Randall Curran from the University of Rochester co-wrote that paper, and he spoke with us about why he believes that we must end football in high school.
The school sponsorship of football is incompatible with the basic mission of schools as educational institutions.
How would you sell them on this idea? What would you say to them, like, look, football, as popular as it is, mm-hmm. could be very damaging to your students, and that's not what your responsibility is. How do you sell it to them?
I mean, it's a good question. I for 20 years I taught courses in education ethics. My classrooms were full of teachers and coaches and school administrators, and my job is to, you know, has been to try to get them all to be able to recognize a serious ethical issue when it's staring them in the face. And we are conditioned by what is normal around us to be blind to these things sometimes. So I think what you have to say is right now, football is extremely popular. It's hard for some people to imagine life without it, but try to imagine life without it for a while. And I think any honest person will recognize that we're going to find a lot of other good things to do, right? Football's not the only great human invention that's ever come down the pike. There are other great ways to spend our time that we can all enjoy together that are less dangerous for kids' brains.
What you're saying is that educators have a responsibility to protecting students, and you think that football is counter to what their job is, which is, again, to protect students.
Exactly. So the so there are two distinct considerations. One is the educators have custodial responsibility for kids. They also, as agents of the state in public schools, they have a special burden that's incumbent on all parts of government to protect children's safety, their welfare, and their development. Sponsoring an activity that is admittedly attractive to a lot of people, they're engaging students in a sponsored activity where the students just doing what the coaches tell them to do are suffering a lot of traumatic brain injury. So it is a failure of the custodial responsibility of educators to sponsor these programs.
Your focus was on football, but there are some other activities that also do put students at risk. And soccer, especially in girls soccer, girls lacrosse, is it a matter of looking at any activity that would put a child at risk? Or again, is it just the focus of football?
If football is a violent sport, the collisions are intrinsic to the game. I don't think there's any way you could modify football to make it safe for the brain. Could you modify other sports where there is some brain injury? I guess it's an open question. It's the headers in the case of soccer. In the case of hockey, it is the contact aspects of it that are make it similar to football. But again, I suppose you could change the rules of those games possibly to make them less hazardous for the brain. But yeah, it's an open question what the breadth of athletic activities is that carry this level of risk.
You wrote an essay that was published in Harvard Educational Review. You wrote a piece that also was on the website Education Week. And again, you're challenging this idea that educators have a responsibility and high school football counters that responsibility. What kind of response have you heard?
I've gotten a lot of very interesting responses. What I didn't expect is that a lot of the people who've written to us, a lot of the people who've weighed in on the blog threads are concerned about the amount of pressure that kids are under to play. The pressure from their peers who belittle them, sort of challenge them, their manliness, their courage to play. And coaches too. I mean, with at least in many parts of the country, declining numbers of students who want to play, there's certainly pressure coming from some coaches. I can't quantify it. So I didn't expect that. The number of people who have pointed to the pressure on kids to play who don't necessarily want to play tackle football.
Did you hear from any educators who agreed with you and who feel, we got to get rid of this game?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I think the overwhelming percentage of people who contacted me agreed. And so that it did include coaches who, acknowledged many of the points, but made, I guess, the point that you've made that, well, there are other sports besides football. Don't just focus on football. But I think that, they made that point with mixed feelings that, okay, it's bad for kids to be suffering brain injuries. We do need to take a broader look than just football. And I agree with that.
And so, let's look at, for example, because you've heard these, the arguments for, and the two big ones are, well, football builds teamwork and self-confidence and leadership. And it's also great for the community and for school spirit. But you argue against those.
So we have studies, including a recent study in which I participated on the character development of 10,000 school children across Britain. And, of course, they don't play American football there, but they play other sports. And a basic problem for the research is having measures of character development. So using the best measures we have, these studies have found positive character development benefits for a number of kinds of activities, including things like theater and debate and public service activities, did not find any measurable, demonstrable benefits in character development for participation in sports. That doesn't show that there aren't such benefits for some children, but it does suggest that the argument that people make that, you know, football, other sports are great arenas for character development, we just have no evidence that it is superior to other activities in promoting character development. So if you're looking at what is cost-effective, what has comparative advantages in promoting character development, right now we have no evidence to favor sports over different kinds of activities in which we can engage children.
Football is an expensive sport, and you look at cost, and some schools may struggle with just keeping up with their budget issues already, and then you have this on football. You did point out in your essay a school in Texas that had to cut its program and instead use money to enhance other departments. Is that a rarity, though, or do you think that that's happening more often now?
Well, I mean, some have cut football, and I don't know to what extent the financial aspects have been determining their decisions, but I think they have to be aware of it. If you're trying to serve students on a per-student participant basis, football is very, very expensive. I mean, if you know, we could sponsor club sports that would serve more children to be able to participate and at much lower per-student cost. I mean, costs have to be a concern for the public and for the school districts. And I think, again, that does weigh in favor of focusing in a serious, honest way about what's educationally beneficial to children and trying to do the best we can within limited budgets.
In Pop Warner or high school, you have to have parents' consent, the guardians' consent. They have to sign the waivers and so forth.
Right.
Why is that not enough? To say, like, look, the parents have decided my kid can play. Why should the responsibility then be on the teachers or educators?
Well, the responsibility is on the teachers and educators. There's no way around that. And so the question, they have their own responsibilities. Parents have their responsibilities. If a parent decides that they're okay with their child being subjected to that level of risk, that doesn't negate the school's responsibility, the educator's responsibilities. So the ethical and legal effect of parental consent, just it does not make the responsibility of educators go away. That's just not how the law and ethics of responsibility go. You have multiple parties responsible for the well-being of children. They all have responsibilities. That's it. It's that simple.
That was Professor Randall Kern from the University of Rochester. He authored a piece in the Harvard Educational Review making the case for the end of high school football. Now, we asked parents what were their concerns when regarding their children's safety when it comes to a game like football. A ninth grade teacher from Miami-Dade said her school is getting a new football team, and she's concerned about the risk to her students and her sons. She texted in, quote, "I'm tired of seeing students airlifted to trauma centers due to football concussions. I don't want it for my sons. I've seen too many students with very bad concussions." Now, she chose to remain anonymous in fear that she would get in trouble for speaking against the school's new team. If you want to get in on the conversation and tell us your thoughts about the sport and health concerns, go to our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial. We will continue following stories about high school football throughout the season this fall. Well, still to come, we return to Live from the 305 and some psychedelic funk and jazz. That's all next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The band Lemon City Trio is bringing a fresh new meaning to the word funk. Their music is a mix of jazz, funk, soul, and from time to time a little psychedelic rock. Ryan Robertson is on organ, Nick Tanura is guitar, and Aaron Glukoff is on drums. They are the musicians behind the trio. Now, the three of them met in Miami. They joined forces and began rehearsing at a warehouse located in the Lemon City, a neighborhood in Miami that dates back to the mid-19th century and overlaps now with Little Haiti. You might have seen them before perform around the city, like in Lagniappe House and Wynwood Yard. The band joined Sundial to talk about their start, their music, and music venues around the city. They perform at Lagniappe House again Tuesday, October 16th.
I guess the sound that we have is kind of indicative of what's happening musically in the city of Miami right now. And so, I mean, when we first did it, it was kind of like, yeah, that's what we'll have it as. But I kind of like now that it's sort of geographically attached to Miami and that we're sort of a band that's representative of the scene here.
You know what? I was listening to you guys and then just like past interviews that I've heard and read, you guys used the term funk. Is funk the most apt genre? I mean, let's get into defining styles here.
Well, I definitely think we started out more on the funk side of the tracks. Definitely, you know, we kind of came together with a shared love of the Meters and James Brown. I'm back. Get up off of 60s thing. Soul. And that kind of is how we were able to bond musically in the beginning, and then we kind of branched out, and now the new stuff is a little more on the space, I guess, space rock, for lack of a better term.
A little psychedelic sense to it.
Yeah, you know, a lot of delays, a lot of washed out textures as well.
But Brian, how do you define, and I want to hear from everybody, how do you define funk? I mean, you threw out some big names there. I mean, like James Brown and the Meters, but how do you define funk? What does it mean to you?
I think it's really an attitude and an approach. Not necessarily, I mean, people think funk, I mean, definitely dancing goes along with it. But, you know, it's not necessarily syncopated or a certain tempo. I think it's just more of an attitude that you bring with you when you perform.
Nick, what about you? How do you define funk?
Being funky is that, you know, and so, and that to me, it's like, you know, you could listen to all different kinds of music that are like that, like the origins of that term. I heard this in a documentary, so I think it's right. Is you know, like that term was first associated with like Horace Silver, who's like a jazz musician, and there's like hip-hop music you could listen to that's funky, or like Led Zeppelin, whatever. So I guess when we started, it was more of a strict thing. Like, we were playing that specific kind of music, and then that's kind of in us. We love that. We've played it a lot. We still do it, you know, at gigs. We'll, you know, intersperse that between our original stuff. But the original stuff, you know, I guess it's not as strict of an interpretation of, like, what you'd hear from, like, 60s funk.
Aaron, I want to hear your thoughts.
Funk, the word, is, you know, it characterizes a certain kind of swagger, a certain kind of attitude and approach to playing. A little more technically, just, you know, as far as, you know, being a drummer and the way I think about it, it's a certain kind of swing. It's a certain kind of manipulation of the beat with the rhythms and the syncopation. Brian was saying, you know, the band in the beginning, you know, those covers we do were like central to creating this identity and around this music. So the term funk was, you know, the basis for how we got started creating the music. And, you know, the fact that now we've branched out into sort of bringing in rock and roll and psychedelic rock and space rock into it, I think, we're still doing it funky. You know, I think that's, you know, it's so central to what we do.
Nick, you and Aaron, you come from the Frost School of Music at the University of Miami. You know, we had this great interview recently with the director of the music program, Stephen Guerra, and we talked about preparing students for a music career. Here's what he said.
Every musician today that's in school, they have to be a marketer. They have to sometimes be their own lawyer. They have to be their own businessman. or businesswoman. So what we're doing is we're training them to realize that the music business when they get out is so much more than just playing your instrument or using your voice.
So how much of it is that? I mean, he says that's what he's trying to prepare you for, but how much of it is creating the music, performing the music, and then how much of it is, as he said, you got to be your own businessman, you got to market yourself, you got to be your own lawyer sometimes. But, you know, what is your take on that?
He's right.
Yeah, it's all of that. I mean,
and more.
If you want to have a career in music, if you want to have a band, I mean, those two things are separate. You can have all three of us have, you know, careers in music, and we do this for a living, and this band is part of that, but it's also a labor of love. It's also a passion project. It also, you know, we make money doing it. It's all those things in one. And if you want to do it, you have to, you know, the social media, the marketing, the self-management, the booking, the picture. I mean, it comes down to every single little entity down. I mean,
I want to ask you too, especially you, Brian. I mean, you know, because look, you do this, but you have to have your daily lives, and you have to, you know, you got to. We have to be responsible adults. But so you became a dad recently.
That's true.
First of all, congratulations. But I'm curious how that factors into all this now and the touring and the performances and everything else.
We haven't actually been on like a long tour yet. We've been out for a couple weekends, and that works out great. Because, you know, obviously I can get a sitter and all that. But
remember rehearsing and writing and producing, though.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I was thinking about it the other night. Like, I pretty much work from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. That's my work day. And, you know, in addition to changing diapers and warming up, you know, bottles during the day, my wife's at work. I get my time when I really get to focus on my craft is at night. And, but obviously, you know, it's a beautiful thing. It's an inspiration to look at this little dude, in my case, that, you know, you created, and you're just excited to show him what it's like to have a career like your dad, you know?
If he wants to go down that path, you'll encourage it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have learned from my mistakes earlier on in life. And I think, you know, because both my parents were not musicians, and they wanted me to pursue a career in engineering, music engineering, which I still have a passion for today. So, I think they were more just kind of like looking out for me. And I mean, I definitely think if you're trying to make a career as a musician in 2018, you have to really find your niche. You have to really find what sets you apart from everyone else on either your instrument or your voice. And just really focus on that, because that's at the end of the day, you know, when someone's going to call you for a gig, they're looking for a specific sound. And if you're instantly recognizable, then there you go.
You're listening to a previous conversation that we had with the band Lemon City Trio. They're a mix of jazz, funk, soul, and from time to time, a little psychedelic rock. They're made up of Brian Robertson on organ, Nick Tenure on guitar, and Aaron Glukoff on drums. The three of them met in Miami, and they began rehearsing in a warehouse located in Lemon City. It's a neighborhood in Miami that dates back to the mid-19th century and overlaps now what is Little Haiti. Let's return to the conversation. Let's talk about one song, for example, like Blade Runner. Tell us, I mean, first, how describe that song for anybody if they haven't heard it yet?
It's based off of like a kind of delay guitar thing that I'd started, and then we kind of shaped it as a band into something that was more concrete. And yeah, it's got three kind of separate little themes and sections of it that we go through, where there's parts of it where I'm playing the melody or main idea. And yeah, it kind of goes back and forth between these more open, washy, spacey sounds and then into more of a tight kind of funk thing sort of brings back. So that song is kind of a good, in a way, that one's kind of interesting because it brings in a lot of the newest kind of things that we've been working on, newer textures and ideas that we've been incorporating, and then also some of the older stuff too. We'll be right back. open kind of improvised section right before the very end of it, where there's like a guitar solo where it's, you know, improvised, jamming, whatever word you want to use for it.
This, and I want everybody here to share your thoughts on this. We're going to see the closure of two established music venues in Miami next year, the Wynwood Yard and the Electric Pickle. But what role do these venues play in maintaining a vibrant music scene? Just tell me what you're thinking about that when you heard that, especially. Brian.
Well, I was you know, shocked but not shocked, because, you know, having lived in Miami for 15 years, you kind of see the way the wind blows. But I definitely think that music will continue and venues will continue to pop up. And as much of a shame as it is that, you know, a place like the Wynwood Yard is gone, you know, I just think that, well, first of all, okay, so when I got started playing music in Miami in 2002, there weren't really that many venues. And Wynwood was filled with just warehouse space and dominated by artists that were getting cheap rent. And I played basically art openings with my other band, and it was the kind of neighborhood where, you know, you really didn't want to walk around by yourself at night. And things have, I mean, obviously things have changed so much since then. But what I think is, people that are creative minded and appreciative of, you know, new music that kind of pushes the boundaries are gonna always find a place to host a venue.
Aaron, Nick, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with Brian. The Wynwood Yard hurts a little bit because, you know, they just renovated it. They have the stage, they put the tent, and we really dig playing there because it has like a real sound system with the sound guy and the whole thing. I think that, you know, inevitably other things come around, and like Brian said, like other windows open up where other ones close, and certainly I don't ever get in a mindset where I feel like I get trapped in some kind of negative headspace about the developers are taking, you know, this is a process of any growth in any city, and it's going to happen, and we're going to keep doing our thing no matter what. There'll be places to play, and everybody's going to keep living on.
Yeah,
making
Nick,
music.
What do you think, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy to get very negative when things like this happen because the consequences for us are bad. You know, we play at Wynwood Yard. We'd like to play there. But, I mean, they're going to be reopening somewhere else. And ultimately, it is a sign of a growing city. You know, they're building new condos there. And, I mean, you know, you can say Wynwood's dead or whatever now because it's going to become this commercially developed area. But every city has commercially developed areas. And Miami kind of doesn't have like an urban sort of, you know, I guess South Beach you sort of have, but it has less of that than other large cities. So what the positive spin and what I hope for is that it's just a sign of more people coming to Miami, viewing it as a place that they want to be, that they want to live. And maybe, I guess you just hope that with more of these people, you know, that people are going to want to, you know, go out to things, go to see music. And it's in a way sort of, I feel it puts a little bit of an edge behind us, because I think as artists, we can't just say, oh, everything's closing. It's like, well, what if we became bigger, work harder and do things, and we become a band that people like want to see, you know, like a place will come along. It's not like Wynwood Yard closes and like the scene in Miami shuts down. You know, these places are vital, but at the same time, it's a cycle, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, Miami has just historically had a reputation for losing musicians to other cities such as New York, Nashville, L.A. And I don't know. I just want to say that I really enjoy being part of the scene down here. And I really can't see myself being anywhere else, because it's on the small side. But I love the sense of community that we have with our fellow artists. And, you know, everyone's willing to help themselves out, help each other out.
Brian Robertson plays organ. We heard Aaron Glukoff, he plays drums. Nick Tenura is on guitar. They are Lemon City Trio. Guys, It's such a pleasure, man. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, that was the Miami funk band Lemon City Trio. You can see videos of them performing at the WLRN studios on our Facebook page, WLRN Sundial. And they will be live at Lanyup House Tuesday, October 16th. You will continue to hear the music of South Florida artists every other Thursday here on Sundial through our segment, Live from the 305. Well, finally today, we take a trip down memory lane to an iconic art installation in Miami's history. Artist duo Cristo and Jean-Claude draped 11 Biscayne Bay Islands in bright fluorescent pink more than 30 years ago. The blanket surrounded the islands extended 200 feet outwards. The New York Times called the project skirts floating in the bay. They were massive pink blankets covering the islands. Now, the project was called Surrounded Islands, now celebrating 35 years, and it's celebrating it at the Perez Art Museum. There will be an exhibition honoring the work of Cristo and Jean-Claude, and there will be a talk with the artist Cristo tonight at the PAM. The Sundial team visited the Bulgarian artist Cristo yesterday for an interview, and I asked him about the role his late wife Jean-Claude played in the artistic process. He explained how their relationship was detailed in a documentary about their relationship.
1961, still living in Paris, we met one of the greatest American documentary movie makers, Albert and David Mazels. They became like a part of our family, and they filmed all our project through the making. They're not art film people explaining the project. They're the drama of the project. And that film of Surrounded Island will be shown here to see how we arguing, how we are screaming, how we fight each other together. And this is why this is all the time. And even today, I am missing this incredible critical attitude of Jean-Claude. She was very critical. You can see in the film that argument between us, because she was always saying, why should do it that way, not do it other way?
I also asked Cristo how the project was initially received when it was first unveiled.
The headquarters was in Pelican Harbor. We have a heliport there. We have all the staff, organization, and people often was coming there to talk to us. And I remember vividly that one older lady came to Jean-Claude and say, I like to talk to people who is responsible. Jean-Claude, I'm responsible. Yeah. Madame, this is the most awful things I see in my life. Terrible. It looks like a giant Pepto-Bismol pill. Okay, he thinks like that. After that, a few days later, all the gentlemen came in and said to Jean-Claude, I have to see them. Who is responsible? Yeah, I am responsible. That old man, Madame, I cannot believe it. This is marvelous things. I never see something so beautiful in my life. You look like the giant Pepto-Bismol spill.
That is still one of the best things that I've ever heard, a giant Pepto-Bismol spill. You can see photos of the Surrounded Islands exhibition at the Perez Art Museum and see a Facebook Live of our conversation at WLRN Sundial's Facebook page. Well, that is Sundial for Thursday, October 4th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Thursday, wonderful Friday, a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.